Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Good morning, everybody. It is Sorrow Gone Rogue show with me, Sorrow Gone Rogue, and the end of the year is not coming roguely quickly enough, I think, for most of us. It's seeming everyone's run out of energy, run out of steam. And in a way, that goes to the first issue of the day. And, in case one had an idea that Eskom is really, in every sense, upped its game and has improved its performance, there is one thing that keeps missing, and that is according to an article in my broadband last week. And that is that Eskom's latest financial results have revealed that its energy availability factor has declined and it's failed to meet its targets. Now, the energy availability factor is the percentage of time the power station or a power station has available for use when needed. And it's the fact that this number is not as high as they had intended it to be at this stage shows part of the problem. Now, it is a key indicator of a power utility's reliability and operational efficiency. And part of the problem that this indicates is that while a whole lot of other things have improved with regard to the supply of power and the performance of Eskom, a great deal of energy is now in the hands of the private sector, both business and domestic. So theoretically, the energy availability factor should have been met because less energy is having to be made available than was, say, 3 or 4 years ago. Now, it set targets of 60% by March 2023, 65% by March 2024, and 70% by March 2025. Well, by May of 2025, it was 56.43%, which is well below its 70% target. And to the end of September of this year, it shows that the energy availability factor was 62.41%, down from 62.94% a year earlier. And they say, and here we go, that it's really the slight year-on-year decrease in energy availability in the energy availability factor is due to an increase in planned maintenance. And what it calls this unplanned capacity loss factor, which was slightly higher than last year. What this essentially means is that Eskom's power plants did not show an improvement in reliability and do continue to break down regularly. It's probably by virtue of the fact that the demand isn't as great as it once was before people got off the grid that one is less aware of it. Now, there's also the fact that Eskom is apparently, although it keeps being denied, burning more diesel to keep the lights on during peak times when it can't meet demand. Now, this allegation keeps being made and it keeps being denied. But what's tending to happen is that although the primary energy costs decline by 1%, which is lower spending on international purchases and independent power producers, but at the same time, this is being offset by higher coal usage costs due to inflationary contractual increases, the same sort of increases that we are all subject to, and more extensive use of open cycle gas turbines. So, although it's intended to support the power system, and the constraints of planned maintenance and the higher unavailability of generation plants seem to continue to be an issue for Eskom. And Eskom has really got no closer to essentially outsourcing the provision of energy to the private sector, which has been discussed and supposedly been a possibility for implementation for years. So despite the fact that you do have the stabilization of the power system, the local load reduction measures remain necessary during certain areas during periods of peak demand. And also, of course, you've got the breakdowns, which are not per se, or the responsibility of ESCOM, but supply by the municipalities, infrastructure that is sometimes ESCOM, sometimes it's municipality related. So it seems like much as we try, we cannot quite get out of that energy pressure that South Africa should have behind us, and especially if at some point we hope to grow the economy.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
I'd like to just chat a little bit about the assassination of Marius van der Merwe, who was known as Witness D at the Madlanga Commission. Now, he was assassinated on Friday night just outside his house, I think in the process of opening his gate to get in, into his house. Car went by and pumped a huge number of bullets into him, and he died in front of his children and his wife. He had said that he'd been offered witness protection, but hadn't really said no. There was no amount of security would protect him, and he knew they were coming for him, and that he'd performed the service he needed to do when he testified during the commission. Now, what he testified to was the control that was taken by Ekurhuleni Metro Police Deputy Chief Julius Mkhwanazi, who had ordered the dumping of the body of a man who'd been killed by officers during an interrogation which involved torturous methods of and resulted in the man's death. Now, Julius Mkhwanazi has come out, been revealed in the Commission of Inquiry to have had a fair amount of nefarious dealings and providing all sorts of benefits and essentially blue light brigade type services to Kat Matlala, the alleged businessman, thought to be mastermind behind a great deal of corruption that has taken place within the police and at high levels in the police and in Timbisa Hospital. And he is currently in detention awaiting to appear in court for the attempted murder of his girlfriend, although he's been implicated in a number of other murders. So it seems like the EMPD Deputy Chief Mkhwanazi is a man who would have much evidence not in his favor against him that could seek to be silenced in some way or the other. Obviously, they have not linked it yet, although somebody has been arrested and a couple of other people are in the sights of the police for van der Merwe's murder. But what strikes me as sort of unfortunate and perhaps a little bit an element of hubris on his part, I mean, the authorities have said they offered him witness protection, but as someone who is involved in security, one would have thought that he would have seen to it that take up an offer or made sure that his family were safe, and that there was an element of perhaps a little bit of machismo and hubris over the fact that he didn't actually take any substantive measures. I mean, any number of people involved in this commission, both people in for example, the NPA and witnesses, have faced death threats during the course of this commission, and it would be a matter of time before something would happen to somebody, whether it was as revenge for giving away, for revealing information, or to warn them off about it, or to warn other people off about giving up information. And even if, as they did, they protected van der Merwe's identity during the course of his giving evidence, I presume that anyone who would have had access to the evidence given would have known who he was, and anyone who was worried about being fingered or angry about it, angry enough to do something about it, wouldn't have had any trouble knowing who was giving up that information. So, of course, it does raise the question about whether this sort of giving up behind closed doors, giving up information in that format as opposed to appearing live and clear, is a better way of giving evidence, or whether, in fact, there have to be many more protective procedures put in place, or thirdly, whether the best way to limit the possibility of being assassinated isn't, in fact, by being very open, upfront, and public about it. It's a difficult thing to tell. I mean, of course, what it has resulted in is people like President Ramaphosa saying they have, you know, we have to improve our witness protection programs. That is probably very true, and much there's been much complaint about the quality of witness protection in this country. But on the other hand, you also have a man who has been in the system and is in has taken his expertise from the police services to the area of private security, and arguably should have known better, or you know, should have not performed that service of giving the evidence that he did at the inquiry, unless forced to do so by a subpoena. But somehow, one just gets the sense that all of these factors put in a row everyone seems to have been guilty of some level of failure to act properly, both the police services, perhaps more insistence on security by the commission itself, the fair sort of laxness with which he regarded his own security, or if not his own, his family's. So one's not sure quite what was at play in this regard, but it is, one has to admit, a rather strange set of circumstances. So something to bear in mind, but in our very lawless environment in which we're really putting the most senior of the police and security services in the dock, all that's going to come out is inadequacies in the system, left, right, and centre. And talking about inadequacies, would you be surprised to learn that 190,503 driving licences, which have been linked to quote, deceased individuals, have been withdrawn or cancelled, rather, after extensive fraud and maladministration has been uncovered at driving tested centres by the Special Investigating Unit. And needless to say, they're identified in critical vulnerabilities in the Electronic National Administration Traffic Information System, which is ENATIS, on the one hand, and it's there being no integration between it and Home Affairs on the other. And needless to say, driving license centre officials have been manipulating the ENATIS system by transferring outstanding fees and penalties to dead or unsuspecting citizens, and allowing heavy vehicle owners who may be subject to penalties for various infringements, avoiding paying the debts that they owe to the license authorities. So just yet we have another day in South Africa.
High FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Now, we often hear President Ramaphosa talk about the fact that South Africa is a developmental state and aspires to ever being one, and seemingly that this should be good policy for the development of essentially money into the coffers of the state for the use in improving infrastructure, etc., for our benefit. But and although it came up and tends to and came up at the G20, and as did a lot of comment from the president, that you know the G20 and the Western world in general must help South Africa and African countries in general to get themselves out of high levels of foreign debt, and in other words, and help in many ways to develop South Africa as a country, one has to ask, well, what exactly is meant by a developmental state, and is it a good thing? And if it's not a good thing, why is it not a good thing? And to this end, I have asked Zakele Ntembu, the policy officer at the Freed Market Foundation, to talk to us about it. He did a podcast, an interview on it recently. And Zakele, welcome back to Chai FM, and your feelings on what is a developmental state? What makes it a specific modus of manner in which a state should be run? And is it a good thing?
Hi, Sarah. Thank you for having me back. You know, I like being here. I've done quite a few interviews here, so you know, I enjoy coming to have a chat. And regarding the developmental state, right? Why is it favored? I think the cynic in me, who is super distrustful of politicians, would be like, because it is the developmental model that just gives them all the power, puts them right in the center of wealth generation, wealth creation, in whatever jurisdiction that the politician may be governing in. And as such, this would explain why it is favored so much, right? But the conversation itself is much more broader, because it comes from a certain understanding of economics, right? Of like understanding the creation of prosperity and wealth as being contingent on the state. Now, this is something that I disagree with, but fundamentally, that's what a developmental statism, if we were to call it that, is, right? You need the state in order to create wealth in society. You need the state to be heavily involved in the economic affairs of the country, investing, as they would call it, in infrastructure, spending a whole lot of money. And that is the important part, the expenditure part, because in every case of developmental statism, the implication is that the tax revenue that a particular jurisdiction is able to raise would not be enough, necessitating debt from international finance institutions. And that debt is good. That debt is welcomed. You should get that debt and settle future generations of your citizens with paying for something that they haven't even used as of yet, because, well, the state needs to be investing in the economy. And this is something that we see the South African government is a huge fan of, right? So that's why they come up with all of these plans, these grand plans for our economy that, of course, never come to fruition, because, well, you cannot plan an economy for over millions of people. And I don't think politicians tend to understand that. But yeah, developmental statism most likely favored because it gives politicians all the power.
Well, you've alluded to it in the sense that it basically ensures that the state has more and more control over, theoretically, over what money comes in and what money it has access to. But we look over the last 30 years, and certainly it's after the first 10 years, where we did see the economy grow at one point, over a two-year period, I think it was 2006 or 7 or 8, by 5%. The South African economy has just deteriorated. It has not grown, and yet at every available opportunity, the ANC seems to hold by the position that it must be the fundamental driver of how the economy operates and what money it earns. And they're busy having their sort of the end of year serious conference, you know, looking inwardly at how they're doing and what they're doing, and the omens are not good. I mean, they've not done well in by-elections recently at all. What should the role of the state be limited to, in order for individuals to run their own affairs and to create and respond to economy on a supply and demand basis? What should they be doing, or what should they be limited to be doing?
I think that's a great question, since I always mention it in my videos or in my writing, right, that the state should be limited to protecting life, liberty, and property, as general as that may seem, but that is what the role of the state should be. The state should be protecting your life if it is in danger or it is under threat, should be protecting your property, because that is what you use to trade. That is the basis of any economic activity. So a strong property rights is a fundamental need before any form of prosperity, any form of economic change can happen. And of course, protecting your liberty, because you need that in order to do everything else, right? So I think the state should be limited in that, instead of trying to devise these grand plans. As you said, the last time we had above 1% economic growth was during Mbeki's presidency. And even then, you could say that was, you know, influenced in part by, you know, global happenings, because the entire global economy was in a bubble. But still, we'll give, you know, credit to that part, to that part of the administration. But ever since then, right, the state has grown. Well, I guess in South Africa's history, the state has always involved itself in anything other than the protection of life, liberty, and property. But that is what it should be limited to. Give people the liberty to trade within themselves, ensure that the things that they trade with themselves are protected so that, you know, they cannot be stolen from them, or they cannot be, well, taken from them in most cases than not by the state, and ensure that everyone in your country, every citizen in your jurisdiction is able, has the freedom to trade and pursue whatever opportunity that they may see. Because as you implied, the only way to respond to the economic malaise that we're stuck in is just by giving people the latitude to respond to that, by the latitude to devise solutions for themselves, right? Mm-hmm. And this is a great thing about free markets and free enterprising, is that really it just is contingent on giving people the freedom to figure it out by themselves. And in most cases than not, humans are ingenious. They will figure it out.
I mean, certainly, you know, I think what the state seems, for whatever reasons, and we'll look at those more specifically, but for whatever reasons, the state may feel that it needs to be the engine behind economic growth and be in control of the country's finances. There seems to be and I don't know if this is an ideological thing that's linked to socialist ideology, or whether it's just almost an arrogance, but there seems to be a failure to understand, and perhaps it's because politicians generally have had very poor or very little experience in the business world, to appreciate that individuals, hundreds of thousands, millions of them, have agency. We have the agency to pursue our economic interests to the extent that we are either equipped to, for better or for worse, or have an innate talent for doing so. So whether it be working for large companies that already exist, or whether it has the entrepreneurial spirit to start companies that could become larger in due course, those are the sort of elements of individual agency that the governments seem to have very little regard for. And isn't it a sort of a kind of patronizing attitude towards
it? Definitely is patronizing, to say the least, right? It is, you know, to quote Thomas Sowell, has this amazing book, Thomas Sowell, called The Visions of the Anointed. I call them the anointed, the politicians. They think of themselves as being anointed, as being above everyone else. That is why they think they are justified in eliminating that agency from people, as you have said, because state intervention and state planning in the economy presumes that whatever it is that individuals are doing when the state is not involved is not good enough. Mm-hmm. And as such, but like, the state cannot act. The state is not a body. The state is staffed with individuals just like you and me. And those individuals, why should their agency, why should their understanding of whatever it is that they're supposed to do override my own, right? And this is the great thing about liberty, because it gives everyone the power to just figure it out by themselves. And the state, the politicians, thinking themselves as being, you know, anointed, as being above everyone, they think that they can eliminate the agency. Well, in reality, they do, right? Through various means, of course. We can spend the whole day talking about all the ways the state, you know, inhibits liberty. But primarily concerning economic matters, as I said, it seems that the incentive, right, if we were to look at the South African state as an example, right, politicians do this insidious thing of eliminating agency. One, you would say that, well, they are malicious. I'd be like, of course, well, the consequences are malicious, but the intention itself, you would say, the self-interest, right? Everyone has self-interest. Everyone is driven by self-interest. And as I said earlier on, when you have the power to determine the course of destiny for other people, but most importantly, to benefit from the determination of that course of destiny, as we are seeing through, like, the various commissions of inquiries we always have in the country into how, like, corrupt our politicians are, right? And I'm like, that is why you have to limit the state. But these people are self-interested. They want the power. They want the benefits of running people's lives. And really, I guess, unfortunately, right, this is not a uniquely South African problem. It's just that we have it to a much more, you know, horrible degree, for lack of a better term.
Well, it does seem, you pointed out in your podcast, that it does seem to be a problem with many African countries.
That's true. Yes.
Could that be down to the fact that sort of when much of Africa became decolonized, they tended to And both during the Cold War, they became decolonized, but they also tended to be satellites to the Soviet Union. So there tends to be a hangover of that sort of statist element. Or is it just that having seen what power accrues with running an economy, it was an obvious source to gain advantage, and a lot of advantage would have been through corruption?
Yeah, I think it's a mixture of both, right? I think both things had an influence. Definitely, you know, the 20th century, the Cold War period, right? A lot of African states were satellite states of the USSR, right? But you would find that even African states that weren't satellite states of the USSR, like I think Cote d'Ivoire, right? They still struggle with these problems of, like, you know, corruption that is pretty much endemic in every government institution. So I think it is also in part due to, you know, South Africa is filled with Westphalian states that were in large parts implemented by, you know, colonial authorities. And the way the African state was constructed was in a very extractive manner. Maybe you could say outside with the exception of South Africa, because South Africa had, you know, a settled population, and as such, maybe the state structure had necessitated to be different. But, you know, maybe the understanding, as you said, the seeing that state power brings with it a whole lot of economic power for whatever group controls said state, you know, that may have contributed to, I guess, the problems that with endemic corruption that we do have. But, you know, in my writing and my commentary in general, I always try to preach the reason I'm a proponent of liberty is because it gives one the agency and the responsibility to be in true control of their destiny. So I think that the blame really for Africa's corruption lies with the people who live in Africa, African leaders, the people who vote for those African leaders, if they are allowed to vote, and the people who support them in whatever capacity, right? Like, the blame lies with Africans themselves, because they are the ones who suffer from these corrupt regimes. So irrespective of whatever may have been an influence, right, be it the US, be it the influence of the socialist ideology, or the influence of the type of statehood that you had, or the history of seeing the power that said statehood represents, that is not an excuse for having the form of, you know, corruption that we do have, because ultimately, you, like, there's no way to change it, right? Identifying whatever may have affected it does not help in changing it, but instead identifying that we do have the power to change it, since we are the ones responsible for putting those people in power, at the very least supporting them in some capacity, I think that is much more important to at least, you know, acknowledge.
Yeah. Now, you talked about the sort of the basics that a state should provide and then pretty much get out of the way, being to protect society, to protect society, perhaps to provide for a public education system to ensure that as many people get a decent education within boundaries as possible. What about... And of course, they can't possibly know what the sheer scope of business of economic activity can be. It's best left to individuals and in the private sector to identify those opportunities. What does one argue? What role should the state play in providing the sort of infrastructure that we all need in order to make in order to exercise our individual agency? In other words, roads, railways, systems like that. Is it a state-only function, or is it something, in fact, that the state can identify but should execute with the assistance of a vibrant private sector?
Yeah, I mean, I am pretty much biased, right? I am as libertarian as they come. So I would between those options, opt for the option whereby there is private sector involvement in that. But I'm very skeptical of private-public partnerships, because I think they're a vehicle for, you know, state patronage and corruption. So I tend to look at them with a very so-and-so eye. But any involvement in the private sector when it comes to administration of, you know, state services usually leads to, you know, those services costing less to the taxpayer. And I always want the taxpayer to not pay as much for things. But I think, you know, as I said, I am biased. I'm a libertarian who does not believe that at least public education should be structured in such a way. Maybe we have a voucher system, and then from there we can start working. But I think the role that the government can play, you know, the private sector is already playing this role. I always say this, in South Africa, we are seeing certain elements of the state's collapse, for lack of a better term. So that has necessitated our private sector to be very proactive in ensuring that their continued existence is a reality. And that is why you have, you know, I think our ports is already a public-private partnerships concerning some parts of the ports and the railway infrastructure. And beyond a actual public-private partnerships in South Africa, you have a lot of, you know, just private companies taking over what ought to be state services, or at the very least working with the state. In Johannesburg, we have the whole Discovery Pothole initiative, where a private insurer, right, saw it with themselves, with all the taxes we pay on top of the taxes we pay. Our insurance companies are also seeing it as part of their job to fix our roads. So I think that would be the better option, right? Our state has shown itself, at least currently under its current administrators, that it is incapable of doing a whole lot of things that we would consider basic. Mm. And as such, if they can get help from the private sector, which, you know, for all its faults, the South African private sector, and by its faults, I mean lobbying for more regulations. But for all of those faults, they are quite competent. They are very good. They are the reason South Africa has not, you know, gotten as worse as it could have, because we have a pretty vibrant private sector that is committed to, you know, really identifying the principle of operating in a capitalist economy, which is serving your customers. So, yeah, I would prefer the option of the private sector partnership.
I mean, you can see it in a way in the mining industry, where mines tend to create a whole array of infrastructure in the environment around which they operate, which end up to being to the benefit of the mines and to those who serve the mines and to those who live within mining areas. Finally, Zakhele, what about just the uniformly unlocking the right of people to own their own property, instead of having a situation where parts of society have pay bonds, buy houses, have that as an asset to use against economic activity, and yet others cannot. The houses in the ownership of the state and really need to be released and unlocked, and you actually have to trust people to take the value of those houses and to be able to sell them or not as they choose to, in order to grow the economy.
That is integral, right? Like, as I mentioned, property is what makes everything else possible, but in this case, landed property, right? In South Africa, it has such a history too, because it is associated with a whole lot of, you know, injustice in our past, our government. So you would think that our current government would be committed to giving as many people as it possibly can the power to own their houses, right? That's why the Free Market Foundation has initiatives like Kaya Lamu, which actually does do that, which, you know, is something that I am proud to even work for an organization that does something like that. But it is pretty integral. It is super integral for people to own their houses. You say that it creates this bifurcation in society, whereby you have a certain sector of society that is able to leverage whatever capital assets that they do have for greater economic activity, whilst others, even though in reality, in use, they do have these assets, they are unable to leverage them. That's why you have this, you know, formal and informal economy, and this set of bifurcation in terms of economic activity in South Africa, which overall, you know, disadvantages us, because we have millions and millions of people who could be using those assets if they actually own them for whatever it is that they think is best, that people need around them, right? So it is an integral part, right? It is integral for any economic recovery plan in South Africa to happen, right? The millions of people who live in townships and everything like that, they have to have the ability to own their property.
Right. Well, let's say from your lips to the ears of the ANC, who are busy contemplating why things are not going the way they should. Zakhele, thank you very much for joining us once again on Chai FM.
Thank you for having me, sir.
Connecting our community. From Johannesburg to the world.
When I joined Howard on Chai FM recently, it reminded me once again of how important and valuable it is for our community to have a public platform like Chai FM to share important matters, to hear what the community is thinking and feeling.
This is Chai FM.
Right. Notwithstanding what we've just discussed about, there has been some growth in the economy. The quarter on quarter, the third quarter of this year, the economy grew by 0.5%, and this was the fourth consecutive quarter of growth. The second quarter's growth has been revised higher from 0.8% to 0.9%. And year on year, the economy's grown by 2.1%, which is larger than the 1.8 that's been anticipated. But remember, this does come up from comes from a very low base. And while it offers some good news, South Africa is still the laggard because Southern Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, is predicted to grow at about 4.5%, and we are coming in. We've generally been coming in at below the 2% level, so we've been constraining sub-Saharan growth as a whole. So while there has been an improvement in a number of factors, we're still at very, very low levels, and so much has to do with the very much freeing up the economy that we have been speaking about. From January to September of the year, however, the best performing economic sector was agriculture, forestry and fishing, which delivered a year-on-year growth of 19.5%, which is what one would really like to see in a much broader scale. But the sectors of the economy that absorb the most labor, continue to struggle, and there's a mining, manufacturing, and construction. Added to the sort of not so good news is that APSA's latest small business growth index has found that just 38% of small businesses, now those are the businesses that the government wouldn't begin to think of, you know, it's not within its wheelhouse to even contemplate as being an area that it should be involved in. Those surveyed believe they could survive more than a year under current pressure. Only 38% of small businesses surveyed believe they could survive, and only 24% found themselves in the confidence or growth range. Now, it's very much it's the small business sector that forms the backbone of the economy and the hope for the future of a fair amount of employment growth and a move away from our very high unemployment figures, which have significance worldwide that we really do not should not be proud of. And they say about 3 million small businesses employ around 13.5 million people of the 17 million people with jobs in South Africa. And if you think that as well, that's about 7% of our population pay personal taxes, where you've got nearly 28% on social grants. That is not a developmental state. And although the government seems to take the awarding of social grants as some sign of success, I think it can only be regarded as a huge sign of economic failure. And as I said to Zahele, the ANC would do well to factor in on this in its discussions this week to look at what its electoral fortunes are for the next local election next year and the national, provincial, and provincial election in 2029. Now, the omens do not augur well for this forthcoming local election, and the ANC has done extremely badly in either losing seats or dropping support significantly. Now, odd by-elections, which occur because somebody has died or left a seat or for whatever reason, are not usually satisfactory enough determinants of what would happen at the larger election in the larger electoral cycle, but it's certainly the prognostication for the ANC has not been good over recent months, and we look into the year leading up to the next local election with some interest. Just to sort of underline the ANC's difficulties is that in undertaking their current, it's their national, fifth national general council, they can't pay the salaries of party employees, and apparently party employees include luminaries such as Fikile Mbalula, and this is for the fourth time in 2025 alone. So what they've had to do for this gathering is they've had to get provincial ANC structures to cover the costs of accommodation, transport, and conference materials. Now, part of the National General Council's function is to provide a political school, and perhaps it is one has to take a look at the what comprises the political school and whether it still has an emphasis on the socialism and the socialist ideals of the 1960s as a way to governing a modern economy, or whether it actually is about freeing up an economy and giving people tax breaks, which would allow them to have the confidence to create more businesses, employ more people who will pay tax, and you will then have the knock-on effect in both the amount of spending in the economy as well as the breadth of tax spend, rather than limiting this tax spend to a smaller number of people, but at a higher number of level, at a higher level, which does not make it an attractive basis for creating anything new. And it's very much been at the tension between the United States and South Africa as to what South Africa should be doing to make it an attractive investment partner for the U.S., other than in areas where the U.S. desperately needs things South Africa's got and is prepared to compromise on. And that is any attempt to limit property rights, such as the threat of expropriation without compensation, and seeking at least exemption for BEE ownership requirements that any foreign company would have to oblige by if it were to come into this country to invest in a business. And that is, up front, it would be essentially giving away 30% of its ownership and of its control of its business to black economic empowerment partners that it doesn't choose and is likely to go to a favored set of people or groups of people that have benefited in the past, and certainly not by any stretch to the majority of South Africans in general.
High FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Well, in the same vein, the Minister of Public Works, Dean McPherson, made a presentation to the National Assembly on how his department is tackling the construction malaise within the state. And he's looking at so many projects, government projects, construction projects have been becoming symbols of broken trust, half-built schools, weeds pushing through foundations, clinics wrapped in scaffolding for years, and courts and police stations that exist only as concrete shells. And there's some awful figures about how uninhabitable so much of this sort of infrastructure is for the departments that have to work out of it. And really looking at reminders that people and the public sectors, dignity, safety and livelihoods can't continue being postponed, excuse me. Over the past year and a half, he says they've been working to turn around the situation with a construction action plan, which has been endorsed by the 9 provincial MECs for public works and infrastructure. They're trying to recover delayed construction projects, restore accountability, and ensure that public infrastructure is delivered on time. Now, obviously, the more timeously and the more available it then is, all round has a knock-on effect to the good for the economy. There's also the plan is to make sure that things are achieved within budget, and that the standard meets the needs of communities, not the contractors employed to do the jobs, and that as much as possible, money that for projects, for infrastructure projects, gets ring-fenced for those projects and does not get moved aside into other areas which suddenly develop a need or which run short and therefore cause the original infrastructure project to lag behind. He seems to have had success between his department and the police services with cases of construction-related extortion and mafia intimidation has been leading to increasing arrests and convictions, particularly in KwaZulu-Natal. And they found that site disruptions, which are still a huge problem over a large swathes of South Africa, particularly in the main centres, have fallen from more than 60 a month to fewer than 10. So that does give an indication, and perhaps Minister McPherson is leading by example as to how these issues can be dealt with if there's enough if the state is willing enough to do so and is prepared to get the private sector on board, as well as other state departments, to actually get down and tackle issues. So it just shows that the state and the private sector and a range of departments can do it if they try. So more power to his elbow, and hopefully we'll see the same sort of optimism and positivism about how things can be done to improve South Africa's terrible record of criminality, state of mafia being, and just inefficiency and corruption we can possibly get. So looking into the new year, the message goes, may the message go out from Public Works to other departments, and again, something for ANC to chew on this week. Otherwise, thank you for joining me, and I commend you to my Substack, which is can be found at sara281@.substack.com, where I deal with issues very much from a personal interest point of view on politics and the extent to which everything is about politics. And otherwise, to join me when I once again go rogue again with Sara Gone Rogue next week. Thank you.